Psalm 35, if you'd turn in your Bibles to Psalm 35. Years ago, I had the chance to be on a mission trip in Peru. I was in the town of Trujillo, Peru, which is on the coast. And there's a Bible Institute and a seminary there, and they asked me to teach some courses there. At the time, I was actually filling in for a professor who was not feeling well and wasn't able to make the trip. And but during the weekend, between the weeks that I was teaching, I taught there for 2 weeks. During the weekend, they did a work project, and part of that work project was they were pouring the concrete roof on this church building. But it was a third-story roof, and in Peru, at least in the year 2000, to get concrete up to a third-story roof meant you literally poured it out of the mixer into a 5-gallon pail. You know how heavy 5 gallons of concrete is? And then you carried it upstairs and up ramps to the third story and dumped it where the people said to dump it. And what I found is I carried up a few of them, and my legs were rubber. And so I would grab my next pail, and I'd get up the stairs. Now, the part that really made me question whether I should go any further was the last ascent was a ramp. And there's no OSHA in Peru, okay? It was like a 24-inch wide ramp. And you're 3 stories off the ground, and down below there's like rebar sticking out and all kinds of things. And I'm looking at this going, if I lose my balance with rubbery legs, this is not going to end well. And so about my third pail of concrete, I got up there and I looked at one of the Peruvian brothers because they're carrying it like, yeah, no big deal. And it was an issue of endurance really for me. And I looked at him and I said to him in Spanish, ayuda, which means help. And he took it from me and carried it up the ramp. And I went back down and got another one, got to about that same point. And I realized I'm not getting up that ramp. And I looked at another brother and I said, ayúdame, help me. And he's like, okay. And he takes it. So that's what I did the rest of the time. I thought, I'm going to do my share, but I'm not going to fall to my death doing it. And there are some times that, you know, I would have liked to have been able to say I could do it, but I wasn't in the shape. I wasn't in good enough shape to do it. And just, you know, it was not something I could do. So I asked for help. There are some times that we need to ask for help, aren't there? But there's one to whom we can go for help, and that is the Lord. And what we find in this Psalm 35 is a prayer for deliverance. It's a psalm of David, and what do we see here? It says, plead my cause, O Lord, with them that strive with me. Fight against them that fight against me. He's calling on the Lord to protect him, to defend him. And when we think through David's life, it's a psalm of David, we know that there were many times in David's life that he encountered danger. Not only in battle, but he was hunted by Saul. Later on, he fled from Absalom and Absalom's rebellion. We also know that there were times that he was falsely accused of things, that there were court intrigues that worked against him. And we may not find ourselves in all these exact situations. You may not find yourself having to run into the wilderness and hide, but you may find yourself in physical danger. You may find yourself being worked against politically in some way. You know what I mean? By politically, I don't mean you're running for office. I just mean the office politics or the social network of people is working against you, or somebody's, you know, conniving to work it against you. And notice what he calls on the Lord to do. He says, take hold of shield and buckler and stand up for my help. In other words, get your armaments, Lord. Draw out also the spear and stop the way against them. So here's the picture. Put on your armor, put on your shield, put on your sword, get your spear and stand in the way of these people who are trying to hunt me down. All right. The other night, now this was a couple months ago, it was after a Sunday night church service, and we were driving home, and we passed by the Wawa on the way home, and I needed to get some gas, and I told the boys, you know what, I'll get you a treat tonight, I'll buy you, I think I was buying them a milkshake or something there. And so we went in there, but when we pull in there, the boys and I joke, we call it the Stop and Rob. Not because it's a terrible place, but it's just, after dark, there's some shady looking characters hanging around there sometimes. If you've ever paid any attention to it, okay? And there's shady looking characters in there. And so we sometimes jokingly call it the Stop and Rob because it's right there on Highway 15. If somebody wanted to hold the place up, they could get in and out real fast. It's, you know, a convenience store, and it just the nature of convenience stores. I'm not against convenience stores. I'm not saying you shouldn't go in it. But you should be on your guard if you're at Wawa after dark. It's true at any gas station, okay? And so, you know, we pull in there, and we go in to get the milkshakes. And I had a couple bodyguards in William and Hudson, so I wasn't too worried. But we go in there, and when we go in, And we're waiting for our order. There are two Winter Garden police officers and an Orange County sheriff in there. And I thought, okay, I don't think too much is going to happen in here tonight. Because the shady people always tend to disappear when the police are around. You know, they just kind of like, oh, I don't think I want to be here tonight. And so you feel like a little bit like, here's somebody that might defend me, right? If something starts to go bad, there might be somebody here to defend me. But even more than that, here's the Lord. He's talking in a sense of, you know, symbolically, Lord, do this. But the Lord's actually doing it. He may not have a literal spear and sword, but he has more power than that. Okay? Draw out the spear and stop the way against them. Stand in the way of them that persecute me. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation. Now, this is an interesting word for soul that's used much throughout this psalm. And it's actually the word that means person. All right? Soul, as we think of it, we tend to have the very Greek notion of soul, and that is the immaterial part of a human being. But the Hebrews didn't quite separate people that much. In other words, they believed we had an immaterial part. But they didn't. There was a more holistic idea of you can't really separate body from spirit, body from soul. Those things can't be, you know, it's not the way God created human beings. Okay, that, and we know this, that if you are, you know, tired, isn't it a spiritual struggle to control your temper? When you're well rested, it's easier to control your temper. Well, why? Because your body and your spirit aren't disconnected from each other. Okay, they're connected to each other. Or if you're struggling spiritually, can it sometimes impact your physical health? All right, Jesus said, take no anxious thought. But yet, if you're always taking anxious thought for something, can it impact your physical health? Sure. All right, it can. And many of us have experienced that. I've had times where I didn't perfectly obey the Lord's commandments, or partially obey the Lord's commandments in those regards, where something very worrisome was going on in life, and I thought my worrying might help. That if I could just come up with an answer to it, this would help. And you know, there have been plenty of times, maybe some of you have been in this place where you would love to sleep, you're very tired, but your mind is racing and you cannot go to sleep. Or you go to sleep, you finally fall asleep, but you wake up about 2 hours later drenched in a cold sweat. And you didn't have a bad dream. You're just that stressed. Some of you probably, I've been there. Maybe some of you have been there. That's not great. And it's not because I was unhealthy. I could go to the doctor. He'd take my pulse. He'd take my blood pressure. He'd take a look at my health, whatever measurements they would take, and he'd say, you're pretty healthy. Well, why? Because our spiritual struggle was impacting our physical health. And so here, when he talks about this, yes, it includes my inner man, but say unto my soul, say unto me, my person, my personhood, my individuality, my who I am thy salvation. In other words, God is the one who rescues us. The Lord says to us, I am thy salvation. I am the one who rescues you. Now, ultimately, he's our salvation spiritually. We know that. But can we also recognize the fact that he is the one who delivers us from difficulties? That there are many times in my life the Lord has intervened. I don't mean in such a way that he literally appeared or sent angels that I could see or something like that. But I mean, he's intervened where the situation could go really bad and the Lord turned it. And that sometimes things seem like they were going to go really badly, and the Lord turned it. Verse 4, let them be confounded and put to shame that seek after my soul. Okay, see, that they're coming after his life. Let them be turned back and brought to confusion that devise my hurt. In other words, when they're trying to attack me, may their battle plans be confounded is kind of the idea here. This is the basis on which sometimes I will, you know, pray. I think it would be a wonderful thing to see, you know, Taliban members come to Christ. I think it'd be a wonderful thing to see, you know, ISIS members come to Christ or Boko Haram members come to Christ. But as long as they're not believers, I think it's perfectly right to pray. And I've prayed this about the communist government in China as well, to pray things like, Lord, undo their cause. Because they mean to do harm to the gospel of Jesus Christ and to your people. Undo their cause. Confound them. That's a good thing. I'm not asking that God would get them in some special way. I'm just saying, God, frustrate whatever that evil is that they're trying to do. Frustrate it. Make their evil plans fail, not succeed. Let them be as chaff before the wind, and let the angel of the Lord chase them. Okay, what is I didn't grow up on a farm, but from what I've read and the way this works is that when you have grain, especially wheat or barley or something like that, you have to break the husk off the outside to get to the seeds. And what they would do is they would have a threshing sledge that they would drive over it or hammer it with, and this would break the chaff from the grain part that you wanted. Now, the chaff is light, and so what they would do is then winnow it by taking a fork, basically, and throw it in the air, and the shell would blow away in the wind, and the heavier seeds would fall to the ground. And if you did that for long enough, you could, you know, basically sift it apart and use the wind to do so. So when the chaff is being blown away, this is something that in this agricultural society, everybody in ancient Israel knew that picture. They knew what it was for the chaff to blow away. Okay, the chaff has been described to me something like, you know when you eat popcorn, that thing that gets stuck between your teeth, that's like thin and light, and that you don't really, you know, that's the edge of the old shell of the corn before it popped. The chaff is like light like that, and it blows away in the wind, and nobody cares about it. Nobody says, oh, don't let that chaff get away. Right? It's just blown away, and it goes away, and nobody cares anything about it. Let them be as chaff before the wind. Lord, scatter them, blow them away. Let their way be dark and slippery, and let the angel of the Lord persecute them. Now again, put this in the context of ancient Israel. They didn't have street lights. William and I were in Washington, D.C. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and we went to the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. I don't know if any of you here have been to it. It's actually a very good museum. And if you have a chance, it's not free because it's not government run, but if you have a chance and you can afford it, it's worth the time to go in. There's some really remarkable Bible, historic Bibles in there. But one of the other things there that's interesting is they have some other artifacts like oil lamps. And if you see some of these oil lamps, you realize when the Bible talks about somebody having a lamp, thy word is a lamp unto my feet. I mean, these oil lamps are like 3-4 inches long. And they'd put a wick and some oil in them, and they just had, think of a match flame. I mean, not much bigger flame than that. That was their light. So you go out, I don't know if you've ever gone out somewhere where there's not a lot of human-made light, where it's dark. I mean, dark, dark. If the moon and the stars, you know, the stars are usually there, but the moon's not out, and you get a really dark night, it can be pretty dark. And if all you got is this little lamp, it's the best you've got, but You really don't want a misstep, okay? I remember years ago being in Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. I don't know if you've ever been. It's a national park there. And there's a point in the tour in Mammoth Cave where they have everybody say, okay, everybody stand still, don't move around, and we're going to turn out the lights so you can see what it's like in here without the lights on. And they flip the switch, and it is so dark in that cave. I mean, literally, you talk about not being able to see your hand in front of your face. You can hold your hand right in front of your eyes and you cannot see anything. It's just black. And it's not a matter of your eyes adjusting. There's no light in that cave for your eyes to pick up on. And, you know, if you were to try to walk through that cave, you would probably die. Because there's, you know, things you could fall down into and these kinds of things. And so what he's saying is, let their way be dark and slippery is the idea that, Lord, as they pursue me, as they're trying to harm me, you know, let them try to chase me through Mammoth Cave. That's not really what he means, but here's the picture. In a dark, slippery place and try to find me. They're not going to succeed. In other words, put obstacles in their way. For without cause they have hid for me their net in a pit, which without cause they have digged for my soul. So here's what he's saying. Why? Why is he praying this? Are these just personal enemies and he just, you know, likes to see people, you know, fall into pits and, you know, fall on slippery slopes and these kinds of things? No. Here's what he's saying. What have they done? For without cause. They're not trying to execute justice on him. They're about injustice. They've hid their net. They've digged a pit. These are traps that you would have for people. I remember when I was a little boy, I wanted to dig one of these in my yard. I just thought it would be a good idea to have a big pit in the front yard. And that way, if somebody ever tried to rob our house, they'd fall in the pit. The problem is that, like, the postal worker might fall in the pit, though. You know, there is a reason it's against the law to dig, you know, tiger pits in your front yard. But I just thought this would be a great idea. We need some, you know, booby traps in the front yard. That would be a great idea. was, well, my parents obviously never let me do it. But here's the idea, though. Why would you dig something like that? Because you're trying to trap something. You're either trying to trap some kind of animal, or you're setting it up for people who, you know, might be coming after you in some way. Maybe you're setting it up as a defense even in war. You know, there wasn't an accident that they put moats around castles and these kinds of things. So why would you have a hidden trap for someone? Because you're trying to ensnare them. You're trying to capture them. And they're doing this without cause. They're just predators. They're just predators. We don't use this word accidentally when we mean this. In other words, if somebody's a predator, they're not somebody who has your best interest in mind, are they? You know, if you have the chance to go, say, to Africa, and you go on a safari, you don't go, well, that lion looks like a nice one. He probably won't bother me. In fact, I like kitty cats. Well, that's a bad choice, because that lion could eat you. All right, they're not your friend. And you even, from time to time, hear these kinds of things on the news where, you know, some circus act or something has a lion or a tiger that they do tricks with, and then a switch flips and that cat turns on somebody, and, you know, you're pretty helpless against a lion or a tiger unless you have a really big gun. And so it just goes really badly. And what we find is that when someone's a predator, or something's a predator, you don't put your trust in it. They're not looking out for you. It's like I remember the cartoons when I was a kid that I used to watch. And often there would be a wolf in the cartoon, and he was always trying to trick somebody into his pot. Right? Oh, come on over here. Well, why? Because he wants to eat them. He pretends to be a friend when he's actually a predator. I remember years ago, I had a young lady in a youth group I was in, and she met this young man at Christian camp. By the way, a caution here, okay? Not everybody you meet at a Christian camp is a good person and a decent person. He met this young lady in a Christian camp. She was a lovely young lady. She ended up being valedictorian of her class. She was quite accomplished on the violin, had nearly a perfect score on the SAT. She was a really sharp girl. And she met this young man at camp, and it got, you know, they exchanged phone numbers. And this was before social media was really big. It was around, but it wasn't really big. It was MySpace, so it was a little creepier. And a lot of parents were like, no, you're not going to be on there. So she gave this boy her phone number, and he called the house a few times. And Dad said, who is this guy? She said, oh, it's this guy I met at the Christian camp, Dad. And so he said, no, I don't want you talking to him. You're in 10th grade. You know, I just don't think I'm ready for you, nor do I think you're ready to be getting involved in a relationship with this boy. So she called the boy back the next time they talked and said, my dad said I can't talk to you anymore unless you talk to him first. And the boy said, I'm not going to do that. So what did the boy do? He said, give me one of your friends' names and addresses, and I will mail them a phone card so that you can call me and it won't show up on your phone bill. And you can do this when your parents aren't home. So she started doing this, and Dad found out. And so he got on the phone with the boy, and he said, never, ever have contact with my daughter again. Because it's one thing for you to have contact and me not, you know, agree with it, and it's another thing to be so sneaky and do it. This is a problem. And the young man, you know, was still trying to find other ways. He's trying to contact her, sending letters to the friend's house and secretly delivering them to her. And after a while, she said, you know, he's kind of creepy. She realized he's kind of like stalkerish. Well, there was another young lady in my youth group who had also met him at camp, and she was the go-between. And eventually she developed a relationship with this guy. And we were away kind of at a camp situation again, and I saw this young man, and he was hanging around our group of kids. And I went over to him, and I said, listen, I don't know you very well, but I'm going to tell you I'm their youth pastor, and I don't want to see you around these young people. And he's like, why? What's wrong with me? I'm like, I'm just telling you, I know Sarah's father, and I know that whole situation. Well, Sarah's father's just a judgmental man. I said, well, I know that whole situation, and so I don't want you around these young people. And then I went and found the young lady's dad, and he was there at the situation, and I said, listen, you don't want her to have a relationship with this young man. He's kind of stalkerish. I said, let me put it this way. He's a predator. He's not interested in the best interest of this young lady. He's got other things in mind. And the mom said, well, he's, you know, I don't know why Pastor Klapprich is being so hard on him. And the dad said, well, Pastor said he was a predator. She said, well, and the dad said, no, if Pastor told me he's a predator, I'm going to take his word at that. Okay, now that might sound like I was really harsh on this young man, but trust me, he was not up to anything good. And many of you who are fathers who had daughters know this situation. Some guy tries to get in touch with your daughter and go behind your back and do all that. Yeah, that's not going to go well. So you see the difference. There's a difference between that young man who comes to woo your daughter and to marry her someday and to take care of her. That's a very different kind of guy than the kind of guy who goes, your parents are stupid. Come with me. We can have some fun. Those are two very different kind of men. One's a predator. One's a protector. All right. So young men in this room, if you're single, you should aspire to be a protector and a provider, not a predator. And there are some men out there that are predators. Okay. And don't be that. And so what we find here is that these people were predators, but they were, you know, predators in the sense of mortal predators trying to harm David here. Let destruction come upon him at unawares, and let his net that he hath hid catch himself, and that very destruction let him fall. In other words, let him fall in his own trap, Lord. Protect me. Now, you know, when we read this, it seems there are even some commentators who say this is the sub-Christian ethic of the Old Testament. It's a revenge ethic. This is not a revenge ethic, and it's not a sub-Christian ethic of the Old Testament. The Old Testament and the New Testament have the same ethic. Okay? They don't have different ethics from each other. What's going on here is that David can rightfully pray that the Lord would be his deliverer. Okay? And you have to remember, these are not people who, you know, this isn't just a dispute. Okay, we understand this. I always found it interesting. I would tell my young people this when I was a youth pastor and even here in the early days when I was here and we had the Christian school. I would say, you know, when you pray for the game, don't necessarily pray that our team will win. I hope our team wins. But, you know, which team does God want to win more, this Christian school or that Christian school? You know, that's not mostly what it's about. If only the team that wins is blessed by God, then, you know, a bunch of times we've had God's curse on us as a Christian school, I guess. It doesn't work that way. But, you know, I'm not talking about competitions and rivalries and these kinds of things. But I think it's perfectly fine to say, Lord, if somebody's pursuing me, undo their cause. And especially in the context of the Davidic covenant, of God having promised to make David a king whose lineage would last forever, he's just asking God to fulfill his word. He's just saying, God, fulfill, keep your promise to me. It's not a sub-Christian ethic. Verse 9, and my soul shall be joyful in the Lord. It shall rejoice in his salvation. And we're going to notice here that there are going to be times that the author, David here, will say, here's spirit and truth. Okay, worship, that he's saying, my being shall rejoice in the Lord. I'm going to rejoice in the Lord because he's a deliverer. Here's another reason God is worthy of our worship. Have you ever been delivered by God? And if you say no, then I have to say, are you saved? Then you were delivered from your sins. God has rescued you from sin and death and hell. Verse 9, all my bones shall say, Lord, who is like unto thee, which deliverest the poor from him that is too strong for him, yea, the poor and the needy from him that spoileth him. Who's like the Lord? It's a rhetorical question, and the answer obviously implied is no one. You know, who can do what God can do? And who does specifically this? He takes the weak who are helpless and have no hope, and he delivers them from the strong who seem to be in charge. And so when our Christian brothers say in the early 1950s or in the mid-40s in China, were being persecuted by the communists. And when Mao would say they are running dogs of the imperialists, in other words, the only you Christians are just messengers of the Western Europeans that are come here to oppress our country. And when he would make those kind of accusations and those kinds of things took place, and God watched over them. Who is a God like that? In other words, this is the idea. He's the only God. There is no other God that can do that. Can Baal deliver you? Can Buddha deliver you? No. Only the Lord. And we can rejoice in this. Who is God like that? All my bones shall say. In other words, my whole being, it comes from my very bones. Every one of my bones shall say, who's like unto thee? Verse 11. False witnesses rise up against, or excuse me, did rise up. They laid to my charge things that I knew not. Now he changed the metaphor. Now it's not hunters and, you know, enemy soldiers coming after me. But the idea now is that they're making attacks against me in court. Let me say this. I appreciate attorneys, good attorneys. All right. I know people like to make attorney jokes and like to make jokes about attorneys. But when you need a good attorney is a big help. I also know that just like any occupation, there are some people who are unscrupulous. But having said that, you know, if you have ever find yourself in need of an attorney, and I don't mean, you know, to draw up, you know, documents, estate planning or those kinds of things. Even that might be a little uncomfortable. But if you ever find yourself where, you know, you literally need an attorney to represent you in a situation where you're trying not to get cheated out of money or you've got a lawsuit or something like that going, you know, that is not an easy situation. That is not, you know, I don't want to volunteer for those things. Those are not the situations I want to say, you know, that sounds like fun. Now, maybe if you're an attorney and you do it every day, you're very comfortable. But for me, it's like if I can stay away from the courts of law and lawsuits and those, that's a really a good day. And if I have to go into one, that's kind of a stressful day. No, it's really a stressful day. And so what we find here is that these false witnesses are rising up and they're making false accusations with the implication that It's a capital crime that he's being accused of. In other words, with the implication that he could face the loss of his life for being lied about. In other words, there are certain crimes that in the Old Testament were the death penalty. We even have the death penalty in our culture today. Imagine if somebody could frame you for a premeditated, brutal murder. You could face the death penalty in the state of Florida for that. Imagine if that wasn't true about you, but somebody was making up lies and framing you for it. Would you consider them a good friend? I mean, that would take a lot of work. They would be a determined enemy. And that's the situation that David is facing here. They reward me evil for good to the spoiling of my soul. Now, was David faithful to Saul? Yes. But did Saul and his men reward David good for his faithfulness? No, they rewarded him evil for his good. In other words, I didn't do anything wrong. In fact, I was loyal, and in what I got in exchange for it was false accusations for the spoiling of my soul. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled my soul with fasting, and my prayer returned into my own bosom. I behaved myself as though he had been my friend or brother. I bowed down heavily as one that mourneth for his mother. But in my adversity, they rejoiced and gathered themselves together. Yea, the abjects gathered themselves together against me, and I knew it not. They did tear me and cease not. Here's what he's saying. I tried to treat them right. I humbled myself. I took on sackcloth. I was even concerned about them when things were wrong. But what I found here was that in all of this, they were still plotting against me when I tried to do good to them. I had a friend that used to say once in a while when, you know, you'd hear about somebody doing something and then something bad would happen to them, he'd say, "No good deed goes unpunished." And it was kind of a sarcastic kind of way, you know, it's a sort of a statement, sort of like Murphy's Law, right? If anything can go wrong, it will. I had another friend who used to talk about O'Malley's Law. I said, what's O'Malley's Law? He said, it says Murphy is an optimist. All right? And the point is that, you know, there are times that we might have these jaded concerns and go, there are times in life it feels like I did the right thing and I was good to somebody and they became my enemy. And I'm being punished for doing right. You've probably been there. All right? You've probably been there where you tried to do the right thing and in the process you bore punishment. People were just set against you. And this is exactly what he finds himself in, but in a very terrible way, where you're talking about court intrigues and his life on the line. With hypocritical mockers in feasts, they gnashed upon me with their teeth. He's not literally talking about them biting him, but the idea is they're tearing him down, they're backbiting, they're mocking him. People take a sort of perverse delight in seeing other people in misery. There's just something in the fallen human heart that allows for this. That we kind of, you know, go, ha, did you see what happened to him? I mean, even, you know, what is it that people, you know, watch certain things for? Some people, why do they watch hockey? They want to see the fights, right? Part of NHL hockey is you get fights once in a while. And why is it that, you know, but if you're the one getting punched, I've been there, on the ice, it's not that fun to get punched. I don't know if you've ever been punched. It doesn't feel good. If you've been in that position, that's not a fun thing. But yet, there's a crowd full of people who are in no danger of getting punched, cheering that some guy will get punched in the face. Right? And I'm not talking for, this isn't boxing where it's a sport and it's just, you know, it is part of the game I recognize in NHL hockey. And I'm not preaching against hockey. I'm one who enjoys a hockey game. But, you know, in the same way, why do some people watch racing? They want to see the crashes. And, they think it's kind of cool to watch a crash. And, you know, there is something about a crash. You see a crash on the side of the highway and people rubberneck, right? They gawk at it. Slows down the road. That's off the road, and people are driving slower because what happened there? Crash. They cause another one. We want to see the bad things that happened. And there can be not only a curiosity in it, but it goes beyond that of a kind of, ha-ha, look what happened to them. I remember hearing on September 11th, 2001, that while the news was being played at a Christian college, and they were watching the things unfold, that there were, you know, on the news, you saw people jumping to their deaths out of the World Trade Center, and that some of the young people at a Christian college were laughing. That's not funny. People were literally having to choose between burning to death or jumping to their death. There's no humor in that. Okay? And that there's just something in the human heart, though, that can sometimes take, and we need to be very careful about this, because we can take a perverse enjoyment. I'm not talking about the normal kind of nobody got hurt kind of thing. You know, I've had that where I've laughed at myself even, where I'm walking along and I slip on something and fall, find myself on the ground, and I didn't get hurt, I'm not injured, and I'm like, well, I look like ridiculous right now. Okay, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the kind of perverse enjoyment that you get that somebody else failed, or look what happened to them, or today with the internet, these things aren't around, but I remember there was a group of videos that came out in the 1980s that were videos of people dying, and it became cool for teenagers to watch these deaths. I mean, of like people's parachutes not opening when they went skydiving and things like that, because they were curious about what does that look like. Well, it doesn't look good. That's a perverse curiosity. That's a wrong kind of curiosity. And these people were rejoicing in David's calamities. Lord, how long wilt thou look on? We see this in the Psalms and in Job and other places. Lord, when are you going to act? And this is the beautiful thing about the Psalms, is that they ask these questions sometimes. And they're questions that we face as human beings. I've often told people this. It's not wrong to pray something like this. Once in a while, say, Lord, I don't understand. How long? Okay? We must never conclude that not God's not good, but it's not unusual in our human state to want God to act. In other words, that's different than saying God is unjust and he doesn't keep his word. We should never get there. But there may be times to say, Lord, I know you're faithful, but why haven't you acted yet? Since you're faithful, why haven't you acted yet? And if you find yourself in a big enough trial, you'll find yourself asking that. Just like David. Okay, and this is the beauty of the Psalms, because we can read this and go, I can love the Lord and still not quite understand everything. And not just be, you know, don't worry, be happy kind of response to things. That can be a very superficial response. Lord, how long wilt thou look on? Rescue my soul from the destruction, my darling from the lions. All right, here's the idea. If you had a small child, many of you are parents, you know, I don't know about you, but there are things that I might not try, but I don't think I would have thought twice about, even at this point, if I needed to do it to rescue my children. You know, if there's some mortal danger, you know, there's a 1 foot beam and it's up high and I have to walk across it, I'm not volunteering to do that. There might be some of you in this room that sounds like fun. 100 foot drop, I'll just keep my balance and go across that. No, I'm going to stay a long way from that beam. I'm not terrified of heights, but I don't volunteer for them when I don't have to. Airplanes don't bother me. Roller coasters don't bother me. But you put me on a, you know, 12-inch beam 100 feet off the ground, I'm going to be uncomfortable. Some of you would be like, no, I could, you know, do cartwheels across that and be fine. And you could. But you know what? I would hesitate at that. But if one of my children was injured out there and they needed help, I'd get out on that beam. Because they need help. And here's the idea. Lord, rescue my soul, my darling from the lions. I will give thee thanks in the great congregation. I will praise thee among much people. Notice, first, militarily defend me. That's the picture. Now the picture is defend me in this suit, in this court of law. Be my advocate. Be the one who protects me. Act. And guess what? The response always is, I'm going to praise you because you are a deliverer. You are a redeemer. And notice here, the context is the great congregation. It's this people of God. In other words, I'm going to go to the tabernacle and I'm going to sing your praises. I'm going to worship you there. And so this psalm isn't just an individualistic psalm about the deliverance of David, but it's a psalm with which we can all connect. We may not connect because we have the exact same situation as David, but all of us find ourselves in a situation where we get that news from the doctor that's not such good news about our heart or about our cancer or about something like that. Or we get that news about a relationship struggle, or we have a literal mortal situation where we really are in danger at some point. You know, if you ever have the situation where you find yourself, you know, facing a weapon, that's a pretty scary situation. Some of you maybe have that experience in a wartime situation, but I remember when I was in college, we used to go to Anderson, South Carolina, and we were working on a church plant there, and we'd go to this one neighborhood, which was a really rough neighborhood, and we had a rule that we didn't go on a particular side of the street where all these bars were, because a few years before, one of the guys passing out tracts was pulled into the bar and pummeled a little bit and then thrown back out on the streets. So you didn't go on that side of the street. But we were on the other side of the street, and I came up, a friend of mine and I came up to this guy and went to hand him a tract, and he showed me this knife, and he said, get out of here. And I went, okay. He was doing business on that side of the street. And by that, what I mean was he had some narcotic-type product that he was selling, and people were coming up and buying it. And I had other situations where that was going on. I mean, literally, and I'm not saying this to brave. I was more stupid than brave is really what it was. And I would go up to these guys and give them a tract and talk to them about the gospel. And we'd literally be having a gospel conversation. The guy would come up and hand him a 10. He'd reach in his pocket, hand him a baggie with something in it. And, you know, it just went down while we were sitting there having a conversation. I'm like, this is, you know, rough. And so, you know, you look at this situation, you go, this is hard. But, you know, when you get shown a knife with the implication of get out of here, I'm stabbing you with it, your adrenaline kind of kicks in. And fear kicks in and you go, okay, bye-bye. You have the knife. You're the boss. I'm leaving. So you find yourself, this is the kind of situation David found himself in. There was danger here. For they speak not peace, but they devise deceitful matters against them that are quiet in the land. In other words, they're not just picking on, you know, it's not rival gangs. It's not Al Capone versus the other gang on the other side of town fighting over turf. This is, you know, trying to prey on people who are minding their own business and just trying to go about their business. Many years ago, when I had first come here as the pastor of the church, one of the ladies in our church was shopping at the Walmart down on 50 down here. And she was shopping at the Walmart on 50, and she was in her 80s. And this young man came by and grabbed her purse away from her and knocked her down and ran off with the purse. All right? You know, you are really a lowlife if you knock down an 80-year-old woman for her purse. You got some real problems for the $20 of cash or whatever's in her purse. This is heartless. And this kind of thing goes on regularly in our society where people just don't care about other people. And for whatever it is they think they can gain, they go after them. And here's the idea. They're quiet in the land. Yea, they opened their mouth wide against me and said, aha, aha, our eye hath seen it. Okay, here's the idea. They're taunting him. They've set themselves against him. This thou hast seen, O Lord. Keep not silent, O Lord. Be not far from me. Here's the good news. There's not a single one of these things God hasn't noticed. You know, I mean, honestly, in our society today, if an 80-year-old woman gets knocked down and her purse gets taken, nobody's going to intervene unless there's a police officer very nearby. But most people are going to be like, that's not my problem. Some nice people, after the incident's over, might come over and call 911 and help the lady get up and maybe try to help her get some aid. But while it's going down, they're not going to get in the middle of the fight. They're like, that guy might have a gun. I don't want to get dead. I'll just stay out of this. And so even though there may be times that we feel like nobody's going to help me here, the Lord doesn't not see it. The Lord sees. The Lord knows. The Lord's with us in those situations. Stir up thyself and awake to my judgment, even to my cause, my God and my Lord. In other words, Lord, you see the injustice. Let the injustice rouse your justice to intervene. And, you know, there's some things like this that I'm not sure I'm going to get into the middle of. I mean, I've found myself in these kind of situations where, you know, I'm using gas stations as an example, but I saw this happening one time. There was a couple, and they were having a shouting match with each other, a man and a woman. And, you know, he was saying things to her no man should ever say to anybody, especially to a woman. But I wasn't about to go stick my nose in the middle of that. Nobody was going to die, as far as I could tell. And what was going to happen is they were both probably going to turn on me if I tried to get involved in it. So that was just one that I kind of chose to stay out of. However, there would be other situations which I would think it would be harder for my conscience to stay out of. Okay, somebody's trying to snatch a child, then I would sort of feel like I need to intervene here. I need to do what I can. You know, you see once in a while, see these videos on TV of somebody trying to grab a child out of the shopping basket and the mother gets in a tug of war. Sorry, at the very least, I would feel like need to detain, and we'll call the police and let them sort it out. I don't know who the child belongs to, but the police need to sort this out. I can't just let somebody run off with a child. I would feel like I need to do something at least. I might not be very effective at it. I might not succeed, but I would feel real bad to go, wow, that's really terrible that guy's running off with that baby. That's kind of one where you feel like you have to intervene, right? Other situations like, that's none of my business. We all have that moral line that we have to decide, when do I risk my health and my life? But here's the good news. The Lord is just. And he doesn't not notice these things. He doesn't stand on the sidelines. He doesn't keep silent. Judge me, O Lord my God, according to thy righteousness, and let them not rejoice over me. In other words, David's confident of the fact that there's been unrighteousness against him. And he's saying, Lord, you know your promises to me. You know your righteous standards, and you know that these people who have set themselves against me are your enemies too. They are enemies of righteousness and justice, and judge me. In other words, Pat, you be the judge. I don't want to be judged by these unrighteous people. Let them not say in their hearts, ah, so we would have it. Let them not say, we have swallowed him up. Don't let them rejoice. Don't let them triumph over me. Let them be ashamed and brought to confusion together that rejoice at mine hurt. Let them be clothed with shame and dishonor that magnify themselves against me. So again, he's asking that it be reversed. Because what are they trying to do? They're trying to bring shame and dishonor on David. And he's saying, no, may that fall on them, because may your righteous judgment settle this. And work this out. And there has to be a place in our life where we have to leave these things in the hands of the Lord. And even though there are times we say, Lord, please rouse yourself. How long are you going to wait? The fact is, we have to leave this in the hands of God. There are many times, I don't know about you, but every time in my life I've tried to make things just, I either add another injustice to something by my action, or I become angry and I become bitter because I'm trying to make things just and then not leave it in the hands of God. I've often used this as an illustration, but, you know, there have been times I'm out in the community and I might have a shirt on that says Calvary Baptist Church. Just the other day I was at Ace Hardware and somebody saw the shirt and they said, is Pastor Lamp still around? I said, oh, yes, he's doing well. And they said, tell him so-and-so said hi. And so many times, most of the time, that's the kind of interaction I have. But once in a while I'll come and they're like, is that the Calvary Baptist Church where Calvary Christian School used to be? Yes. And they'll say, I went to that school. They kicked me out. And you can just hear the venom. And I'm thinking, the school's been closed for 12 years. And I don't know you, so this was before my time. I'm not bragging about the school being closed. I'm just thinking, like 30 years ago, and this is still ruining your life? And you went to another school and graduated, so it didn't really change anything in your life? Other than you're just still mad? See, when you're there, you're just, whose life are you hurting? Whoever the principal was at the time, do you think they're at home going, oh, they're mad at me. I'm so upset about that. They don't even know who's being harmed by this. The person that's being harmed is the person who's being consumed by the bitterness. And in many of these cases, you know, I in the early days, I remember talking to Pastor Ron, do you know this family? I just saw them. They were really harsh when I talked with them in the community. Someone would say, yeah, we had to expel their son. You know, he brought alcohol to school or whatever kind of situation. I'm making that one up. But, you know, and he was sharing it with other kids in the locker room or something. And he gives some kind of situation where it's like, of course you can't just let, you know, 12-year-old share alcohol in the locker room. You have to deal with it. But the parents are mad. Can't believe they kicked my kid out. Well, who's this harming, this bitterness? Is this harming you? No. Yes, I mean, the person who's bitter. But is it harming the person you want to get even with? No. There's got to be a point at which we leave justice in the hands of God and trust him for it. Verse 27, let them shout with joy and be glad that favor my righteous cause. Yea, let them say continually, let the Lord be magnified, which hath pleasure in the prosperity of his servant. In other words, God had promised to bless David. And what he's saying is those who are on David's side are ultimately on the Lord's side. May they rejoice, and my tongue shall speak of thy righteousness and of thy praise all the day long. Notice there's kind of three sections, and at the end of each of the three sections, we see a response of praise on the part of David, talking, worshiping in the congregation or praising God for his deliverance and these kinds of things. You know, God is worthy of our worship. And there are so many times that people go through life and good blessings come into their life, and they don't think twice about the Lord. But yet we find the normal response here of the psalmist is to thank God for his goodness, for his mercy, for his deliverance. You know, if you get in a near total car wreck or a total car wreck where your car is totaled and, you know, it was a serious situation and you've gotten, you know, I've had this a couple times where the airbags deploy and these kinds of things. If you've been in those kind of situations and you don't walk away going, Lord, thank you that I'm walking away from this and not being carried away in an ambulance or, you know, to the morgue or something, then you're not thinking right. Because the Lord was watching over you. And it's not just those kind of situations. It's so many other situations in our life where we look at it and things aren't going right. Somebody's got it out for us. And the Lord frustrates their cause. And it ought to cause us to praise God, to give thanks to Him. We're all going to find ourselves in calamities and difficulties, but the Lord calls on us to be people who seek His help and rest in His justice and praise Him because He is a good God. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we do.